This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear an update from Forest Heroes. The group has called on Kellogg to support policies to protect rainforests in Indonesia. But first, longtime civil rights activist Julian Bond will speak tomorrow night at Albion College as part of the school's Martin Luther King Jr. convocation. Before that, Bond is scheduled to be interviewed on stage tomorrow afternoon by an Albion College history professor. WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with Julian Bond last week.
Welcome, Mr. Bond.
Thank you.
As a refresher for some and an introduction for others, Bond has been affiliated with a number of important organizations in our nation's history. He's a founding member and former communications director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that directed successful sit-ins in Atlanta, leading to the integration of lunch counters, parks, and movie theaters there. Bond is the founding president of the Southern Poverty Law Center and is the NAACP chairman emeritus. Actually still sits on the board. You still do that?
Yes, I do that.
The title of the address, at least that Albion College has selected, it's called The Dream, The Journey So Far, and The Challenge Ahead.
Generally speaking, it's a look at how far we've come in racial matters in this country and how far we have yet to go, what we've done right, what we've done successfully, and what we have yet to do.
What has been done successfully?
Well, what's been done successfully is that if you look at my lifetime only, which is a limited period, even though I'm 74, we've passed laws prohibiting racial discrimination, and generally speaking, they've been successful laws. You now can't deny a person a house because of his or her race. You can't deny them a job because of his or her race, and on and on and on and on. And these are good things. On the other hand, although we have this structure of laws prohibiting racial discrimination actually continues to exist. And it's the continuation of this discrimination that we have yet to eliminate, and that's really the job left for present generations as well as people in my age group who are still trying to do what we can. There's lots yet undone, and we need to do it.
What's the way to go about doing that? At your time, there were sit-ins. Is that still the way to do it?
That can be the way to do it. There are, you know, a number of techniques and methods that people of all races and colors can use to advance their cause. The techniques of yesteryear are still good today. In fact, I'm surprised to the degree that people do not employ a nonviolent protest. It seems to me good in the past, and I think it would be good in the present day, but it apparently has fallen out of favor, and not as many people as I think could tend to employ it today. So there's much that we could be doing, marches, protests, lawsuits, I mean, just a long, long laundry list of things people could do to make sure that this is a decent society for everybody.
You were an associate of King. What was the nature of your contact with King? And tell us, you know, a side about him, perhaps maybe that we did not know.
Well, I had a unique relationship with him that I'm very proud to discuss and happy to discuss. I am a student of Dr. King's. You know, a lot of people say that. Oh, yes, I was a student of Dr. King's. But Dr. King only taught one time. He only taught one class. There were only eight people in the class. I'm one of the eight. So I'm one of eight people in the entire universe who can honestly say I was a student of Dr. King. Dr. King taught a course at Morehouse College. He co-taught it with the man who had taught him philosophy. It was a philosophy class. And I was one of eight people, six from Morehouse, two from Spelman College, who took that class.
Tell us about the private band. I imagine, you know, yes, you had that student-teacher relationship, but it did progress beyond that.
Not a great deal. I can't say I was his very best friend. But I think people think of him as a kind of somber figure, and I think he portrayed himself as a somber figure in public. And like many public people, he had a public face and a private face. And the private face was very different from the public face. You see this man dressed in a dark suit, smiling occasionally, but typically serious-minded and serious acting. But he was a funny person. He liked to tell jokes. He liked to tease people. Among his friendly circle, he was always teasing people. He believed, against all the evidence, that he was a great basketball player, but he was relatively short in stature and could not, although that's not a prohibition against being a good basketball player, it seemed to be so for him. And he was a person who enjoyed life And I don't think you get that from the public king, but you certainly could get it from the private king.
There's the 50th birthday of the March on Washington for Freedom and Jobs. I have interviewed a gentleman recently who, in fact, actually was at the original march and went to the commemorative one. Were you at the commemorative one?
Yes, both of them. You know, they had two commemorative ones.
Yes.
But I went to both of them.
You were at the first one as well?
I was at the first one, yes. I was then working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it was one of the sponsoring organizations of the march, and each organization was asked to give staff members to staff the march, and I was chosen as one of the staff members from SNCC. And part of my job was distributing speeches. Each of the speakers was asked to deliver a copy of his or her speech, or really his speech, because there were no official women speakers at the march.
We're talking about the one in 1963.
The original 63 march, right. So I passed out John Lewis's speech to the media, and I was careful to point out that John was the only speaker to say black people instead of Negroes or colored people, as was the fashion of the day. I thought that demonstrated how militant we were. The newspapers seemed not to be interested in the slightest way. But part of my job, too, was giving Coca-Colas to the movie stars. And I gave a Coca-Cola to Sammy Davis Jr., and he pointed his finger at me like someone holding a gun and said, "Thanks, kid." That's one of my great memories of the March on Washington.
When you went back last year, last summer, for the commemorative marches, what ran through your mind? Did you tear up?
No, I didn't tear up, because there had been another commemoration somewhere midpoint between that, I guess 25 years after the original march.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was sort of a return to familiar ground. It was a sort of mixed occasion. On the one hand, happy that we've had this 50th celebration, or these two celebrations a few days apart. President Obama, as you know, spoke at one of them, and a pantheon of famous people spoke at both of these commemorative marches. I spoke at both of them. And I kept thinking, why are we having two? Why are we having two? And to this date, I don't know what the answer to that question is, but we did have two. And they were generally well attended, one more so than the other. But they were happy occasions. Sad occasions in the sense that there are people who should have been there who could not be there because they passed away, but happy because those of us who could be there were there and got to see each other again for at least one last time.
Fast forwarding to present day, you do spend a lot of time on college campuses. Right now you have an affiliation with American University.
Mm-hmm.
Are you called a scholar in residence there or a distinguished professor?
Yes. Well, I call myself professor, but I am a professor in residence. It sounds as if I live there, but I don't live there. I'm not sure what that means, but that's okay. I'm happy to take it. What it means, I teach there.
Uh-huh.
I teach on Monday afternoons and have done so for 20-plus years. I taught the University of Virginia until May of last year,
mm-hmm.
and I've taught at Harvard, at Williams, at
and I believe Drexel, yes. So you spend
yeah.
a lot of time on college campuses. Here's what I'm wanting to know. I am curious to know, in all those many years that you've taught over those 20 years or so, tell me about the knowledge level of students, and not just students, but also Americans in general, about civil rights.
When I first became a college teacher, it's something I had never done before, and I wanted to make sure I wouldn't speak down to my students. And I was teaching at Harvard, and I constructed a test of their knowledge to see what they really knew, so I wouldn't be, you know, just repeating things they already knew. And I was disappointed to find out that they didn't know much. And it's interesting, the Southern Poverty Law Center has a little adjunct group called Teaching Tolerance, and they, 3 years ago, conducted a study of the readiness of high school students in America for further learning about the civil rights movement. And the findings were just pathetic. They knew two names, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and four words, "I have a dream." And that generally sums up the knowledge that high school students in America had on civil rights. They're just about to release a catch-up survey done recently, and the results are a little better, but not as great as you'd get them to be. And they've got a list of states, all the states, and the states have various grades. And it's interesting that the states that tend to have the highest grades are the states with the biggest black population. Now, that's good news and bad news. It's good news that they're teaching civil rights at all. The bad news is that it suggests that they think it's only something that black people ought to be interested in. That's not true, and that's not the case, and I hope that's not why they do it. But so the improvement, there's been an improvement, but it's not as great as one would have to think or would hope would happen.
Why is it that you believe that all races need to know about civil rights, that it's not exclusively something for African Americans?
It's American history. You know, this is not black history. This is American history. This is the history of Americans, black, white, of all races and colors, who struggled to improve our democracy and who succeeded to some extent. And it's a story that needs to be told. All of us need to learn it so we can learn how to keep doing it, how to continue this path. And unless we know what happened in the past, we can't do it in the future.
You talked about that there are certain things that young people do seem to know about civil rights. What are the parts, and I realize it's a very large history, but what are the parts that you wish that they knew more about?
I wish young people, college-age young people, high school-age young people knew that this movement was conducted to a large part by people just like themselves. The numbers of high school students, the numbers of college students who were active in the movement and who worked, who suffered and who sacrificed and who lost their lives is something that's not as well known as it ought to by others. You know, this year we're celebrating, or celebrating is not the right word, we're memorializing the Freedom Summer from 1964, in which about 1,000 young people, most of them white, spent the summer in Mississippi registering voters, creating opportunity, expanding rights, and three of them died in this struggle, Mickey Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman. And we're commemorating them this year. It's a sad anniversary, but their sacrifice ought to be better known by more and more people. There's a documentary called Freedom Summer, which is going to air sometime this summer about that. And Americans will pick up a little more knowledge about it than that. But they shouldn't have to look at TV to learn about these things. They ought to learn them in school.
But in general, how about adults? How are we doing in terms of our knowledge level of civil rights? And
well, you know, adults used to be students.
That's true.
From going to these schools that didn't teach this subject as well as they might. And so their knowledge is relatively limited. I lead a civil rights tour of southern states every year for the last 6 years, and most of the people who come on this tour are people who are curious about it and want to know more. They know something, but they want to know much more, and they're on my tour, they meet people who made the movement, the people who are survivors who are still living, and who can say, I was there, I talked to Dr. King, or I did this thing, or I did this thing. And many of them describe it as a life-changing experience. These are people who know something about the movement, but who want to learn more and want to learn it from the people who did it and who made it. And this tour gives them an opportunity. And there are other tours of this sort that take place around the country, and there are large numbers of young people. I find when I go to Birmingham, for example, when we go to the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, there's always a busload of kids from someplace in the country at the museum learning things. So you have to think the knowledge is improving, but it's not improving as fast a rate as you'd hope it would.
We've been talking a lot about young people and actually the power of young people. And if there's any doubt that they can be powerful, you talked earlier about how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee helped be a co-sponsor of the original March on Washington. But what I also want to point out is about yourself. When you were in college at Morehouse in Atlanta, around that time, you were elected to the Georgia House.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, not so amazing. I was 25, and I was the youngest legislator then, but not the youngest ever. Long before my time, there had been people older than that elected to the Georgia legislature. So being elected at that time was not unique. But yes, I did get elected to the Georgia legislature, and they threw me out, and I got reelected again, and they threw me out again. I got reelected a third time, and finally that stuck.
Talking about being thrown out, let's talk about you just even trying to get seated there to begin with. When you were first elected, they refused to seat you. This was back, what, in 1965, somewhere in and
yes.
around there, because of your opposition to the Vietnam War and the draft.
Right.
And the lower courts actually affirmed their decision, but it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, and I remember sitting in the court next to my lawyer's law partner in the spectator section of the court and listening to the Attorney General of Georgia telling the court that Georgia had the right to throw me out. And in the middle of his argument, Justice Byron White, better known as Whizzer White, because he had been a football player in college, interrupted him, as the justices will do. And he said to him, "Is this all you have?" He said, "You come all this way and this is all you have?" And I hunched my lawyer's partner. I said, "We're winning, aren't we?" And he said, "Yes, we are." And we did. We won 9-0. The court ruled in my favor. And so I was seated finally after much struggle to get in there.
Some of the big issues that you're involving yourself with these days, my understanding is economic justice is one of them, environmental concerns is one of them, gay rights is one of them. Tell me a little bit about why you have passions in those various areas. I know, for example, that you boycotted Coretta Scott King's funeral because it was held at a church that opposed same-sex marriage. And apparently while she was living, she was a strong supporter of same-sex marriage.
She was. And it's something I think most people don't know about her. That's one of the things about the civil rights movement that we don't know, that she was a strong, strong supporter of same-sex marriage and spoke at rallies and acted out in favor of sexual equality and did everything that she could as a living person to make this possible. And when she was funeralized at a church which was pastored by a raving homophobic pastor, I just couldn't go to that. I couldn't find myself there, and so I didn't go.
What makes you passionate about same-sex marriage and gay rights? It's obviously a controversial issue in the civil rights movement, particularly in the traditional Black church.
I have gotten a lot of flack for it, but interestingly, the flack has diminished. I think attitudes are changing not only among Black Americans, but among Americans generally. Just in the newspaper today, there's a story about some state legislature or some court action advancing the cause of same-sex marriage. I think here's an issue that I had to approach when I was working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or even when I was in college. I went to college with gay people, gay men from Morehouse College. And, you know, there were all these jokes and laughter about this guy and this guy and this guy. And it also always seemed so small-minded, so simple-minded to laugh at John or Frank because he had a same-sex attraction that my other college colleagues did not have. And this was something he had been born with, not something he chose to do. And how can you blame a person for some condition that he's born with? How can you, it just seemed intolerable to me that you could do that. These were decent people. They were friendly people. Some of them were nice people. Some of them were not nice people. But they were people, and they didn't deserve to be mistreated because of some condition they'd been born with. And I just couldn't find that tolerable.
Yeah, I remember reading an interview where you talk about that gays and lesbians are discriminated in the past and present, like Blacks are.
Yes, and you know, one of the problems I think gay people face is the ignorance of the larger population that thinks they've chosen this life that they live, when in fact they were born to it. And some of these people were active in the civil rights movement with me. They helped me to win my civil rights. And I can't turn around now and say, "Listen, thanks for helping me, but I'm not going to help you." I mean, that's just something I could not do, and I don't think anybody would do if they understood the role they'd played in helping me. You know, if it hadn't been for a gay man, there would not have been a successful march on Washington. Byard Rustin was the organizer of the march. He was openly gay. He was honestly and expressionally gay, didn't care who knew it. That was who he was, and he helped to make that march the great success that it was. Now, how can I turn around and say, "Well, I'm not going to the march because Byard Rustin is gay"? I mean, how stupid would I be if I said that, if that was my attitude?
As we bring this interview to a close, let's talk about some of your environmental, your passion in that area. Where does that come from? Is that something that you've always had?
I don't think I've always had it. I've grown into it as I've become conscious, as more and more Americans have, of what we're doing to our environment. You know, our air and water are not as clean as they ought to be, and all of us ought to be concerned about this. Why do we let our air become foul? Why do we let our water become foul? You see what's happening today. I can't even remember where it was. There's some state where people can't drink their water, some small town where because of environmental depredations, they can't drink their drinking water. Can you imagine that? Waking up and turning on your tap water and finding out you can't drink it. So this ought to concern everybody. It shouldn't be just some people who are derided as tree huggers or people who are nutty about these things. Everybody ought to be concerned about these things.
Mr. Bond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Longtime civil rights icon Julian Bond spoke with WMUK's Earlene McMichael. Bond will speak tomorrow night at Albion College as part of the school's Martin Luther King Jr. Convocation. That begins at 7 o'clock tomorrow night in the college's Goodrich Chapel. Prior to the convocation, Bond will be interviewed by Albion history professor Wes Dick on stage in Bobbitt Auditorium. That begins at 4:10 tomorrow afternoon. You can find links with more information and a longer version of this interview at WMUK.org.